The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So what I thought to reflect about this evening is peace. This could be looked at as the goal of our practice in a way. Sometimes in certain places in the Buddhist texts, the word for peace is used as the word for freedom. And there's one particular discourse. It's a pretty old discourse, actually. Many of the Buddhist texts have kind of undergone revision, apparently, in the course of their life of being quoted and transmitted orally. And this particular one, it's an old text. It's called the Atthakavagga. It actually is quoted in some of the other discourses. And so there's a sense by scholars, at least, that this discourse is less altered than other discourses. And it really directly speaks to this question of peace in several places. And so I thought I'd start by actually sharing some of these words. And in both of these places that I'm going to share, it's kind of in a question and answer form. Somebody has come to the Buddha. And actually in this whole text, you get the feeling of a Buddha who's kind of wandering around by himself. In some of the other discourses, you get the feeling of the Buddha surrounded by hundreds of people. And in this text, you get the feeling that he's kind of, you know, wandering around, and somebody comes up to him and says, "Hey, can I ask you a question?" And he says, "Sure." And so it's got much more of a personal quality to it. So this question begins directly with the question of peace. The questioner asks, "Having what vision, being of what character, is one called peaceful? Tell me about the Supreme Person." And the Buddha responds, and I'll read a section of this. "A person who is free of craving before the body's destruction, who is not rooted in the past or the future, nor defined with regard to the present, and who is free of yearning. A person who is not angered, not frightened, not boastful, and not worrying, who gives wise advice, is not agitated, is careful in speech, a sage. A person who does not cling to the future nor sorrow over the past, who finds seclusion amidst sense contacts and is not led astray by views. A person who is retiring, not deceitful, not covetous, not selfish, not impudent, not arousing contempt, who does not engage in malicious speech. A person who does not relish pleasure, who is not conceited, who is mild and of ready wit, who is not credulous and not bored. A person that does not take on the training in the hopes of material gain, who is unperturbed if one gets nothing, who is not obstructed by craving and is not greedy for flavors. A person who is even-tempered, constantly mindful, who does not suppose that anyone in the world is equal, better, or lesser, who is free of conceit. A person who is free of attachment, who, knowing Dhamma, is not attached, someone in whom no craving is found, either for life or not life. This is someone I call peaceful." A couple of things that I find interesting about this description. The first thing that he says is basically the peaceful person doesn't, is free of craving, isn't pulled to the past or the future, and is free of yearning, and is also not defined with regard to the present. You know, in the guided meditation, I pointed to this a little bit, you know. Let go of thoughts of the past, let go of thoughts of the future, and even let go of ideas about what should be happening now. Now, this is a way to peace, that we come into just this lived experience without yearning for it to be any other way. So that's one piece that he brings in, is this notion of someone who is balanced in the midst of whatever is happening. Life, as is being lived, doesn't pull us in any direction. Well, this doesn't mean, in my understanding of what the Buddha taught, it doesn't mean that we just sit like a lump on a log and don't do anything. But it does mean that rather than taking action out of reactivity, out of anger or confusion or desire, out of greed, aversion, or delusion, that rather the choices that we make come from wisdom, come from balance, come from a mind that is not reactive but is more responsive. Approaching life from a perspective of wisdom rather than reaction. And so this description to me, I mean, it may sound like someone who's free of yearning, who's free of craving. The way we usually live our life, we are kind of driven by greed and aversion in so many ways, you know, that we want to have things, we want to get rid of things. Pretty much if we look at how we engage in our lives, much of our choices are made out of wanting to have something pleasant to hold on to or get rid of something unpleasant. And so this pattern is deeply embedded in our way of living life. And it's hard for us to conceive that there might be another way to make choice. That choice might come not from reactivity, but from compassion, from kindness, from balance of mind, from wisdom, from generosity. So this is just one piece I like to clarify, because when we hear free of craving, we think, well, free from yearning? Why would one do anything if one were free from yearning? And this is partly because we can't conceive, or we don't have the understanding yet about what it means to be free from yearning and how action comes naturally from wisdom in that place. So that's where he begins in terms of his description of a peaceful person, a supreme person. And to me, that description of a person free from being pulled to past or future, free from being agitated about what's happening here and now, that opens to me a person who is at ease, at rest, in just what is now. But he doesn't stop there. He goes on, and one of the things that I think is so really highlighted in this particular poem is the person who is peaceful is described by very ordinary qualities. Not angered, not frightened, not boastful, not worrying. Gives wise advice. Retiring, not deceitful, not covetous, not selfish, not impudent. Even-tempered. These descriptions, to me, one of the most inspiring things about this particular text is that it really describes the goal, the result, the possibility of our practice in terms that are very down to earth, very understandable to us. It's not described in terms of someone who has transcended the world. It's not described in terms of deep states of concentration or bliss. It's described in terms of very simple qualities that one has essentially mostly let go of. A lot of these are things we've let go of: not angry, not frightened, not boastful, not worrying. And so there's this flavor in this text of not only the quality of a person who is free being describable by things that we could recognize, states of mind that we can recognize, but also many of these descriptions are things that we experience in relationship to other people. We often experience anger in relationship to other people, fear in relation to other people, worry in relation to other people. We boast to other people. And so the relationship to others, the description of a person who is peaceful, has a very even-tempered relationship with other people. And so this is another piece that I find interesting in this particular text, that the peaceful person is described in relationship. Again, not as somebody who's like, you know, sitting off in a cave somewhere, but someone who's living life, someone who's engaged in life. The second poem I'd like to share is somebody again asking about the peaceful person. And first the questioner asks about what is this state of peace, and how is somebody free in that way? And then he goes on to ask, and how does one get there? So this is a question we might be interested in. How do we get there? How do we become peaceful? So I'll read this one. I'll read pieces of this one again. This one's a little bit longer, but I won't read the whole thing. I'll just read some sections of it. I ask about seclusion and the state of peace. Seeing in what way is one free of passion, grasping at nothing in the world? And the Buddha responds. And again, he starts kind of with a fairly pithy and deep teaching that we may not get immediately, but I'll read it anyway. The Buddha said, "The sage should put an end to the root cause of psychological distortion, the thought I am. Ever mindful, one should train oneself to abolish whatever craving one finds in oneself." So this kind of speaks to that first piece, the very first piece of free from craving, free from yearning, not worried about the past or the future, not identified essentially with anything happening in the present moment. The Buddha speaks to that here, that he points to the root cause of all of our struggles being this notion, I am, I exist. Now, I'm not going to try to do a talk on that topic tonight, since my topic is peace. But just to put that out there, that the Buddha pointed to that as kind of the core, the middle of our issues, kind of the foundation upon which our struggles arise. But he goes on later to be much more down to earth as far as the exploration of the path goes. So I'll continue here. Whatever one is aware of, either within oneself or externally, one should not allow it to be a cause of obstinacy, for this is not called peaceful. One should not think of oneself as better, inferior, or equal on account of anything. Although affected by a variety of experiences, one should not acquiesce in the thought of self. One should find peace within, not seek it from someone else. For one who is peaceful within, having taken up nothing, how could one reject anything? That's a particularly potent teaching, I think. Seek for peace within, not without. It's kind of the pith of that verse. And so often we look for happiness, peace, outside of ourselves. We try to construct the world so that we can be peaceful. We try to find things that we can have so that we can rest finally. We try to get rid of things so that we can be at ease finally. But this whole process by which we go about trying to find peace, when we're looking for it outside in that way, inherently we are kind of like a hamster in a hamster wheel, endlessly kind of, oh, maybe I just need to do this little bit and then I get to rest. And then, you know, maybe you get to rest for 2 seconds and then, oh, but I need that or I need to get rid of that, because things are so constantly changing that if we are seeking peace without, any peace we manage to construct in that way is so ephemeral. It's almost immediately vanishing even as it comes into being. And so this habit that we have of looking for happiness, looking for peace outside of ourselves, actually keeps us caught on the spiral of unease, of not being peaceful by its very nature. And so, looking for peace within, that's kind of a cryptic statement, I think. Although we may have a kind of an intuitive sense of that at times. At times where we have had a little bit of a moment. I remember one moment when I was probably no more than 8. I woke up one morning in my grandmother's house and heard the sound of a mourning dove. And there was just the sound of the mourning dove. And in that moment, there was a sense of timelessness. You know, just this 8-year-old sitting there feeling this spacious timelessness. That was a taste, I think. We all, I think, have some sense of that possibility of ease, of peace, that comes when we let go, or when we're not trying to find something, when we're just here in this moment, opening to the sound of a bird, or the sound of a train, for that matter. I think we do have an intuitive sense about what this means, to find peace within and not look for it without. It comes next with an analogy. In the depths of the ocean, there is no ebb and flow, nor do waves swell up. So there should be in one neither the ebb and flow of desire, nor the swellings of conceit about anything. Then the questioner asks further, tell me about the path of practice. Essentially, okay, you've told me about peace. How do I get there? How do I do that? And here again, I find this to be really interesting. The Buddha responds. Some of this may be familiar, may resonate from what I read earlier. So listen for similarities to what I read earlier. A person should not have covetous eyes, should close his ears to ordinary chatter, should not be greedy for flavors, should not cherish anything in the world. Being meditative, one should not be footloose. One should desist from worrying and not be indolent. One should live in lodgings where there is little noise. One should not be given to oversleeping, should be given to wakefulness, should abandon laziness, deception, merriment. One should not fear blame, nor be conceited when praised. One should drive out greed, selfishness, anger, and malicious speech. One should not be a boaster, should not speak scheming words, should not make an habit of impudence, should not utter quarrelsome speech. One should not be moved to tell lies, should not be deliberately treacherous, should not despise others for their way of life, for their wisdom, for their moral conduct and religious practices. If contemplatives or other people irritate him with their talkativeness, he should not respond harshly, for the peaceful do not retaliate. And I want to stop with that sentence, with that verse, because it brings in two pieces. First of all, I want to point out basically here, in terms of what the Buddha says the path to peace is, he's basically suggesting that we model where we're trying to go. Almost all of these descriptions of what we should do and should not do reflect what he said a person who is free, who is peaceful, naturally does. And so there is this sense that the path here is kind of a different, maybe slightly different perspective on the path than we often explore. The path is not so much about constructing anything, but about modeling people who are wise, about modeling our behavior to be what we would, where we would like it to head. And so this sentence here, if people irritate one with their talkativeness, one should not respond harshly, for the peaceful do not retaliate. First of all, here it says, irritation might be arising. You know, it's not that you're going to be perfect on this path. You're probably going to experience anger and frustration and irritation and confusion and boredom. What he's saying here, though, is when irritated, don't respond harshly, because the peaceful do not retaliate. So again, modeling peace, he is encouraging us to behave peacefully, even if we feel irritated. This is, I think, one of the key takeaway pieces that I bring from this text. That we should explore what it might mean. Now, again, you know, we're not going to be perfect in our minds. Our minds are going to have all kinds of stuff going on. But there is the possibility, and unfortunately in many ways, our behavior is easier to control than our minds. We have very little control over our minds much of the time. You might have noticed that if you've spent any time watching your mind, you know, just how hard it is. You know, you sit down to meditate and, you know, you tell yourself, yes, I'm going to pay attention to the breath. And three breaths later, you're off having an argument with somebody in your mind. It's like, you know, wow, what kind of control do I have over my mind? We have very little, initially in our practice, we have very little control over our mind. And we don't have to give up because of that. We can keep practicing. And the mind does slowly change direction. And this practice, basically to me, also I think a lot of this text points to practice in daily life, not just practice on the cushion. Because he's talking about how do we engage? How do we work in relationship? Again, it's a very relational teaching here. If people irritate you, don't respond harshly, because the peaceful don't retaliate. So what does that mean? And this to me, I'd like to explore this. This has actually been a practice I've used for quite a number of years now and have learned a lot and have gained a lot from this very exploration. What does it mean to be feeling agitation in the mind, to be feeling irritation, impatience, annoyance, and behave peacefully without repressing, suppressing the mental, the state of mind. Because that's a key here, that the repression, suppression of irritation, you know, if it's like, if the way you engage in this instruction, if people irritate you, don't respond harshly, if the idea you take away from that is, oh, I shouldn't feel irritated, and we try to pretend we're not feeling irritated in order to behave peacefully, that actually just drives the irritation underground. It's overlaying a form of aversion on top of the irritation, and is kind of repressing the irritation using another unskillful mind state. So this is not, in my understanding, what the Buddha is suggesting. And the way I've explored this is to really open to, when I'm noticing something in my mind, irritation, impatience, agitation, I begin to check in. Is okay, I'm really going to allow this state of mind, but is it leaking out into my behavior in any way? Is it expressing itself through my body in any way? The very first time I tried this, I'll tell you about the very first time I tried it, and then I'll tell you about several things I was exploring today, so you can get a sense of the range or the flavor of this kind of practice. The very first time I tried this, I was shopping at Long's, and I noticed that the mind was impatient, and I guess I had some place to be or something. You know, it's like I need to get through the shopping and get to where I need to be. And I noticed the impatience in my mind. And I also noticed that I was picking up things off the shelf and throwing them into my basket. So my physical body was expressing the impatience. Essentially, that there's a real strong feedback loop between the mind and the body. And when we allow a mental state to express itself in the body, it's essentially reinforcing the intention of that mental state, in this case, impatience. So the impatience was there, and my picking things up and throwing them in the basket was actually encouraging the impatience. And so when I noticed the physical manifestation of the impatience, I decided to see if I could smooth out my actions. So I began picking things up carefully and placing them in my basket. Not repressing the impatience, I was really interested in clearly, like, okay, what is this impatience? And can I have the impatience, allow the impatience, so not try to repress or suppress the mental impatience, but also not express it through the body. And through that very action of not expressing it through the body, I was actually quite surprised to see that within 30 or 40 seconds, it wasn't very long, the impatience in the mind just vanished. And there was much more peace in my being. Just that very, very simple thing of looking, how is this state of mind impacting the body? And not letting, I kind of think about it as like not letting the state of mind leak out into our actions. So this is what I understand him to mean here when he says, if ordinary people irritate you with their talkativeness, one should not respond harshly, for the peaceful do not retaliate. Not repress the irritation, but not express it. Is that possible? Is it possible? It gets challenging, I think, in terms of tone of voice. as we speak, sometimes our emotions constrict our throat, so it can be challenging to do this in relationship, in tone, in our speech, but I think it's possible to explore this. You know, how might I speak in a way? I mean, there's the what we might say to somebody when we're irritated. You know, the way we speak to somebody, the words that would come out. That we may be able to recognize or shift. If we have this if we're carrying through our day this question, how might I engage peacefully in the world? If we're carrying that question through our day, then we might be able to notice or to see the tendency to say harsh words or speak divisive words. So we may be able to change the words, reframe it, not say something. That would be a step in the right direction for us. And we may also be able to relax the body a little bit. This was the thing I was exploring today a little bit more, seeing just the subtlety of how states of mind impact the body. I was sitting in a chair, and I noticed I was feeling a little bit uncertain about what I was going to talk about tonight. And so there's agitation, a little agitation in the mind. The mind was kind of, you know, thinking, you know, racing around about what it was, you know, what do I want to talk about tonight? And so I was sitting in the chair, and I noticed the body was in a pretty relaxed posture, but the hands were kind of fiddling. So I noticed there was, you know, a little bit of this agitation was leaking out in my hands. So I let my hands relax. I let my hands be at ease, and I just allowed the mind to do its thing with the irritation. I mean, the agitation, the searching. What am I going to do tonight? And then I noticed that there was a little bit of tightening in the face, so I could relax that too. And with the relaxation in the face, there actually was a release of some of the what I saw actually in retrospect was a little bit of struggle with the mind that was searching. The mind was searching for something to talk about, but it was also feeling like there was some problem. I don't know what I'm going to talk about. This is a problem. You know, there's a little bit of worry that I hadn't really clearly seen. But when the face relaxed, that part relaxed, and then there was just the mind kind of reflecting, thinking, exploring. Much more peaceful. The body was very relaxed, and the mind was just doing its thing, trying to think about what might I talk about tonight. So this practice can be a very interesting one to explore when we are feeling something challenging, a difficult emotion. What might it look like to be peaceful, and then not repress the mind state, not repress what's happening in the mind, but see if we can model peacefulness. Model peacefulness. I'll read a little bit more here. Knowing this Dhamma, one investigates it and should train oneself in it. Knowing the cooling of desire as peace, one should not be negligent in applying these teachings. With regard to the Buddha's teaching, the Blessed One's teaching, he called himself that. With regard to the Blessed One's teaching, one who is diligent should constantly venerate it by following his example. Again, pointing to this, modeling those that are peaceful. So exploring this in daily life, this teaching to me. And it doesn't. In one of the places it said one should be meditative, but that's like one sentence. The rest of it is very relational. So to me, this is talking about practice all the time, practice in life, practice in relationship, practice when you notice you're irritated, practice when you notice you're confused, practice when you notice you're bored, all the time in daily life, in relationship. This is not easy. It's much easier to sit down and meditate and close your eyes and be mindful. Most of us find it easier to do that than to engage with mindfulness in daily life. There's so many things that support us when we're in sitting meditation. You know, we often are sitting in a particular posture. Often our eyes are closed. Both of those things support us to remember being mindful, remembering our practice. And even then, we see the mind kind of going out, right? I mean, how many times did your mind wander in that 35-minute sitting? 50? 100? Many, many times the mind wanders. So even with the support of the reminders of the stillness of body and kind of checking into the present moment, we forget. And when we're in daily life, even those simple reminders get taken away. So it's much harder. It's often much harder in daily life to be mindful. I think one of the reasons, a couple reasons why it's hard in daily life, and, you know, we have a perspective in daily life that there's important things that we need to do. You know, we need to go to work, we need to buy food, we need to do our laundry, we have to accomplish these tasks, do these things. So we have all of these activities that we think are important and are important in many ways. And so they're prioritized. And they're usually prioritized above being mindful. And yet, I don't think we have to think about it as prioritizing mindfulness over anything else. Although one of my teachers, Sayadaw Utejaniya, I just got back from spending 2 weeks with him in Massachusetts, and he was saying that one of the reasons we struggle with mindfulness in daily life is that we don't appreciate the value of mindfulness. We don't appreciate what it does for us. You know, we do know, in some ways we can know what mindfulness does for us. A few things some of you, you know, may have experienced, that when you settle in meditation, for instance, when you close your eyes and start checking into the present moment, you can begin to feel a kind of a letting go of the agitation of your life. You might see that there's a little more space around struggles. You know, you might be able to recognize, oh yeah, this is anger arising, or this is irritation arising, and that's okay that that's arising, and feel a little bit of spaciousness around it. That you might begin to recognize and know how helpful mindfulness is, because we also see, I think a lot of us see, just how much the habits of our mind, the usual way that our mind works, drags us into all kinds of old patterns and habits of confusion and anger and frustration. And in my early days of practice, I really got to see over and over again just how conditioned my mind was to go to anger, just how much it went in that direction. And I began to see just how much suffering there was around that anger. really beginning to appreciate the value of mindfulness as a way, as a part of the tools that helps the mind not just follow those well-worn paths over and over again. So much of our suffering is created by the habits of our mind. And with mindfulness, with wisdom, there's more choice. There's more possibility of not just habitually going the direction that we have done over and over again. So that we begin to see the value of mindfulness. We begin to understand that value. My teacher says that if we really understood the value of mindfulness, there would be no question we'd practice it constantly. Because it is this pathway to peace. This practice is the pathway to peace. And so we can begin to appreciate that. With this notion of prioritizing mindfulness, of not prioritizing mindfulness in our daily life. What I think happens there is that we think of mindfulness like everything else in our lives. You know, we think of mindfulness as another project to do. It's like, okay, you know, I've got so many hours in the day and I'm going to, you know, use so much of it for work and I'm going to use so much of it for my taking care of my house and my buying food and taking care of my body and so much of it for fun. And then, okay, well, maybe I get to do a little bit of it for mindfulness too. So we think of mindfulness in that way as just like something else to add to our day. And I think this is a way that we misunderstand the possibility of mindfulness. Because actually, mindfulness doesn't weigh very much. It doesn't have to be a project in the way that, like, okay, let me spend, you know, 30 minutes of my day being mindful. There's this capacity of our mind that just simply knows. In a very light way, right now, are you aware that you're sitting? Are you aware of what the experience of your hands is? Are you aware of the sensation of your lips touching? How hard is it to do that? It actually doesn't take a lot of effort to be mindful in our day. It's the hard part is remembering it. That is hard. It's challenging to remember it. But when we actually remember it, in that moment, just a light touch, this is really what I encourage people in daily life practice, not to think about mindfulness being something that you're picking up and carrying around like a backpack. You know, like, okay, I'm going to carry mindfulness with me all day long. It actually is really light. It doesn't weigh very much. And it can be present right in just a split second. It just is a kind of a light touch in this moment. And then, you know, there may be a little bit of encouragement to in the next moment, and the next moment, and the next moment. The level of effort is kind of like the level of effort you need to hold on to a balloon, a helium balloon with a string. You know, you need to remember to keep your fingers pressed together. But it's not a lot of effort to do that. You know, it can be just the lightest touch to hold that string. That's kind of the level of effort that we're talking about. And we forget. We forget all the time. So the relationship to the moment of remembering, the relation, like when in sitting meditation, that we talk about this a lot in sitting meditation, the moment of waking up in sitting meditation, the moment when we remember, when we've been lost in thought and we come back and we wake up, we talk a lot about having a relaxed, easeful relationship to that moment. No need to beat yourself up. No need to judge yourself. You're already mindful. Celebrate. We talk about this a lot. So, you know, it's like in that moment of waking up, just notice what you've become aware of. In daily life, it's very similar. In the moment when you remember that you've not been mindful, just notice what you've become aware of in that moment. What's obvious in that moment? That's, and another helpful tool in that moment is to see if you can recognize the distinction, the difference between what it was like a minute ago to be lost and what it's like now to be here. So kind of get familiar with that flavor of awake. Get familiar with that flavor of awake, because it actually happens a lot during our day. Effortlessly, it happens a lot. This moment of waking up and knowing, here I am walking down the street. Here I am driving my car. Here I am picking up something from the ground. We come into awareness all the time, only we have a habitual relationship to that, to in the way, oh, here I am driving. Oh, where am I driving? Where am I going? You know, oh, there's that car. That's an interesting car. I've not seen a Tesla before. You know, we jump on what we've become aware of, and we lose the fact of being aware. So the more familiar we can get with that waking up, that state of waking up, the more we'll recognize it when it happens. And this begins to pull this thread of awareness through the day, which allows us to then begin to explore things like, oh, there's irritation in the mind. Can I not let it leak out into the body? You know, that we begin to be able to play with these tools that the Buddha suggests. I also have found it interesting to explore another interesting tool in our daily life is to look at how much effort are we making in our activities. There's an interesting exploration about how much are we making with respect to the mindfulness. We often tend to kind of overdo the mindfulness, particularly in daily life. But just in whatever we're doing, like I was at the gym today, and I was noticing, as I was doing the bicep curls, you know, I was doing this, and I was noticing that the mind was really engaged with this. It's like, so I don't know what it was doing, but it was like, it was trying, the mind was trying to lift the weights. And I realized, well, actually, you know, the body can lift the weights. There needs to be a little bit of an intention to do that, but there doesn't need to be this, like, crunching in the mind while the biceps are crunching. And so seeing that, the mind began to release that extra effort. It's like the mind was doing way more work than it needed to do while I was at the gym. We do this all the time, washing dishes, washing vegetables. I remember on one retreat, I was washing vegetables, and I noticed I was just like, the whole like mind was just contracted around, I've got to do this right, I've got to... It's like the whole mind was squeezing around doing that job. It's like, wow, this is just washing vegetables. Can the mind let go of that extra stuff? And a lot of this exploration can be around, how are we using our effort? Are we using more mental effort than we need to accomplish a task? Let's explore that. And physical effort. It's also interesting to look at physical effort. One friend commented a few weeks ago in this retreat. He was exploring this question of effort in his activities. And he said, you know, I picked up my toothbrush and I saw that, you know, it's a new toothbrush. You know, it's not very old. It's maybe a month old or something. But the bristles were already completely mashed. He said, I must be using way too much effort in brushing my teeth. You know, so this is just look at this. How are we over efforting? I think we we might find there's a lot more energy in our lives, a lot more energy freed up if we just begin to explore this question of how are we using our effort? And then this other piece about just holding this question of peace, holding the question of what might it mean to be peaceful in this moment. This was when I thought of this text, I began playing with that all day long, and you know, it's just like really shifted my day to be using that as a kind of a almost like a mantra. But not just a verbal mantra, but just as a reminder, there's a possibility for peace here. What might that be? How might that be possible here? So there's only a couple minutes left. Are there any thoughts, comments, questions, anything?
Well, just out of curiosity, there was one section where you said the question of I am. Is that I am ellipsis? I am this, I am that, or is it I am,
it was,
I exist?
It was I am, I exist. It was actually the thought I am in quotes. So I think it is just simply the existence. Yeah, that's my understanding.
And then I can't remember the
whole thing. Which then is the root of I am this, I am that. Yeah.
Then the other thing that I can't remember all of, but having taken up peace, or having taken up nothing, how did that work?
Having taken up, let's see if I can find this. Do you remember any other words that were in there?
It was at the end of what you read. I mean, not at the end of the total, but at the end of that piece. I'm sorry, I was realizing that there was a gap in my memory, and so I...
Yeah. I don't remember that word, nothing, having taken up nothing. Let's see, the last piece I read was, knowing this Dhamma, one who investigates it should train oneself in it. Knowing the cooling of desire is peace, one should not be negligent in applying the teachings. Be diligent by following.
I think it was in the second section, actually.
The second section. Should not cherish anything in the world. Should not be given to oversleeping. I'm not seeing that piece in here. So maybe afterwards I can look a little bit more and see if I can find it. But it's time to stop. So thank you for your attention.